I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
The Athletic.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime. Please welcome the team of the Fulhamish podcast.
It's the Fulhamish podcast, your independent voice of Fulham FC. My name's Sammy James. Welcome to the show, brought to you by The Athletic UK. And it is the Thursday Club, and we're going to be looking ahead to this Saturday's SW6 derby, reflecting on a weekend where Fulham didn't play, and wasn't it quite nice? Just admit it. And also, we're going to be talking Tyrese Francois, Fulham's fatal final 15-minute collapses, and the social media boycott by Premier League and Football League clubs that's coming this weekend. As I mentioned, it is the Thursday Club, so I've got Peter Rutzler here. Hello, Peter.
Hey, Sammy, how you doing?
Fine, thank you. And Jack Collins.
Hello, listeners. Hello, Sammy. Hello, Peter. How are we doing?
Fine, thank you. How are both of your respective house moves?
Yeah, slow and steady. Slow and steady. I'm commuting back home because there's no internet at my new place. So it's become, I feel like one of those people who moves into the city for like 4 days in a week and then goes back to their family, apart from doing it in a complete reverse order. I move back to my family, okay, 4 days a week and then go back to the flat for the weekend. So, but slow and steady.
Such a modern house moving problem. No internet, isn't it? This didn't used to be a thing back in my day. And Peter, how's yours? You do seem to be into yours. So you're one step ahead of Jack and you actually have some working internet.
Well, yeah, working internet, but it's mobile hotspot, so I'm in the same sort of boat. But it's doing a really good job this morning, I have to say. Lovely weather as well, lots of light in the flat, so that's keeping me happy, and yeah, it's going well.
Beautiful. Have you done your jaunt down to Craven Cottage? Yeah, I'd say you're walking distance now. Now you're in Wandsworth.
I haven't yet. I've done a few rounds of Wandsworth, but I haven't got down to the cottage yet. But there's still time.
Well, there's not lots of time, to be fair, with the season coming quite short.
I got to the cottage yesterday, Sammy, so that's exciting.
How's it look? I mean, everyone seems to get annoyed when they ask for updates of the Riverside Stand, but I'm genuinely interested to know how it looks because I don't live around there anymore and I don't see it on a daily basis.
It's a building site, would be my take on the matter. It's going up. That's all I have to offer you. It's going up and it looks like it's more up than it was the last time I saw it when I was there. So it's moving along, but I don't have any details to share with you on the metal work.
You're such a part of the building site FC brigade. It's so upsetting. At least Peter likes to share a nice photo of it every once in a while. Peter, I can get on board with.
Everyone loves the photos. Although I was getting some sort of pushback against the photos, although they do quite well. It's quite nice to see all the seats go in and everything else. It does change quite quickly.
I do think you have a slight advantage, Peter, is that you're allowed to take it from inside the ground.
True.
Obviously, everyone can go to the other side of the river and take a photo from Putney. That's quite easy. Getting inside the ground is actually more access than most people are able to get at the moment. So I think maybe that's why you get less pushback. I enjoy them. Anyone that posts a photo of the Riverside Stand, at me on Twitter and I'll give you a like. I'll appreciate you. Okay, let's get on to the weekend's results that very much didn't go our way, Jack.
No.
Your final words of last podcast was, you Wolves did not do us a favour in the slightest.
No, you Wolves actually basically killed the relegation zone, the relegation fight dead, didn't they? Look, I think there's an argument to be made that Wolves have, after scoring against us in the 93rd minute and then letting Burnley walk all over them 4-0, have done more to, you know, instigate our relegation than almost any other side in the Premier League aside from Fulham. So there is not particularly pleased with the old gold over Wolverhampton, to be honest. This is not what I was after at all, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, Peter, I feel like the only result that did actually go our way in the end was maybe West Brom not winning, because we might be able to cling on to 18th.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, silver linings and all that, Sammy. I mean, it does sound like you're clutching a bit there, but at least they're getting the same rough treatment when it comes to the last 15 minutes and that Fulham aren't alone on that front. But yeah, as you say, I mean, Wolves did not do any favours at all.
Brighton lost.
Brighton did lose, which is interesting because I still don't consider them to be in this at all, but they do just have an uncanny ability to be shit.
Yeah, 100%. Look, I hate to be the bearer of optimism, but Brighton are probably now the only side that Fulham can catch. And look, imagine how well that tweet will age if we do actually catch Brighton. But I do think 7 points is a tall order.
7 points plus a massive goal difference, so effectively 8 points.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know what to make of Brighton. They seem to be okay. Everything else seems to be fine with them. I mean, they're similar to Fulham in that they can't score goals, but I mean, I don't generally see too many poor performances. I mean, by all accounts, they did quite well against Sheffield United, except the fact that they lost. So, I've not really sort of seen them. But if we're actually looking at it now, and if we want to be to take the Jack optimism stance, you know, if you're saying that Burnley, Newcastle, maybe still on the fringes, then maybe you look at Southampton too, if we're really pulling it, because obviously Fulham play Southampton as well. It's sort of been forgotten a little bit in this run-in, and Burnley as well. And you know, if somehow Fulham can get the wins, obviously we haven't seen too many of them this year, but if they can, I mean, that's 6 points to those two teams as well. The goal difference isn't a million miles away with either of them.
I mean, Jack, if you're looking at runs that have killed Fulham, though, you can look at Wolves and Brighton or whatever. Newcastle getting 8 points out of Spurs at home, Burnley away, West Ham at home and Liverpool away. Now, I know that home and away doesn't matter that much this season, but even so, that run of sides, three out of the four of them chasing Champions League, one of them, you know, a really impressive Burnley side that we saw at the weekend. If there's something that's actually sent Fulham down, it's that run that when we spoke to Chris Woff less than a month ago, you never could have seen that coming.
No, he said he didn't know if they'd win another game, right? And they've won two, drawn two of their last four. So look, they've turned up when it mattered, and they've scored goals when it matters, and they've won games when it mattered. And ultimately, Fulham haven't been able to do that in the periods where, you know, we talked about, and we looked at that Leeds game and the Wolves game. But the Arsenal game, I think, obviously the manner of it hurt, but maybe that's actually something you look at quite separately, because to go to Arsenal and get 3 points would have been, you know, the first time Fulham had ever done that in the modern era. So it does feel like, you know, those are the games where Fulham needed to get the job done and instead settled for points, and Newcastle have gone and won games, gone and got results when they needed to, and that's the difference between them staying up and us looking like we're going down, unfortunately.
Peter, it is remarkable, given the stick that Steve Bruce was getting less than a month ago, that insipid defeat they had at Brighton 3-0, to turn it around to this. I mean, Newcastle fans won't want to hear it, but Steve Bruce deserves some credit. Yes, Sam Maximan and Wilson returning have helped, but it cannot all just be down to two players.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the heat he was taking, the pressure, the noise, I mean, the abuse, really, during that period, and to somehow not just pull the results out the bag, that's one thing, but to keep that dressing room fighting, you know, he seems to have put together some kind of siege mentality there. You know, there were all the stories that were coming out about Matt Ritchie and others that sort of discontent, and yet somehow that they have all pulled together. They have got the ducks in order and have been able to pull off these results. And, you know, you can't overlook the impact of Alan Saint-Maximin, as you mentioned. And Callum Wilson hasn't really returned yet. I mean, he's only played, you know, a couple of games off the bench during this run. So, you know, that's one key difference. But fair play to Steve Bruce, because to come under the fire that he's come under, and, you know, to put Newcastle in this position where they are essentially about, what, a win away now for absolute certainty for survival, that's been remarkably impressive.
And Jack, I guess with Newcastle, sorry, this hasn't turned into Newcastle-ish, it's just interesting.
Toonish.
Considering the predicament it's put us in. The Athletic does have a Newcastle podcast, which you're more than welcome to listen to anytime you like if you're enjoying the Newcastle chatter today. Has been the arrival of Aloney, and Aloney that's very much worked for Newcastle in the name of Joe Willock. His ability to find goals, especially late on in matches, has been, well, been a real a saviour for Newcastle, particularly the point that they got at Anfield, which I think may be what sees them safe.
Yeah, it's the antithesis of Fulham, isn't it? He comes on late and scores goals. And I suppose that's it, isn't it? That's the difference. That's the changing of the guard. And And when you look at him and when you look at what he's offered, it's been brilliant for them. And it's been one of those moves that's just worked out for both parties. So, yeah, I mean, look, full credit to whoever decided to bring him in from a Newcastle perspective, who saw that as what could be the answer to a lack of creativity, a lack of engine in that kind of attacking midfield area that gave them something new and something different in that rotation. And yeah, when things work out, they work out. And this is definitely one that's worked out from a Newcastle perspective. And it's a sad thing for Fulham because it could be what, you know, ends up condemning us to the drop. But, you know, at the same time, you look at those January signings and they're brought in to make an impact. It's exactly what he's done. And you can't really knock that.
I mean, I'm a bit worried, Peter. There seems to be a real negativity in the fan base about the concept of loans. And I totally understand it. Fulham have been probably too reliant on loans in the last 2 to 3 years. And the clear scapegoat of the loan strategy at the moment is Ruben Loftus-Cheek, right? And we're seeing Jesse Lingard have a successful loan. We're seeing Joe Willock have a successful loan from a kind of Super League club to a normal Premier League club. And our loan hasn't worked out. I'm worried that in the future, the fan base is going to be completely dismissive of all loans, despite the fact that in moderation they can work. But maybe Fulham have just pushed it a little bit too far in the last couple of years.
Maybe. I think when we're talking about the last couple of years, and then maybe you look to the Championship season after relegation and Knockhart and Cavallero and the big fees that came after them, I think that's more of a fair criticism. I think when you look at this season, it's hard not to detach the reality of the market at the moment. And, you know, and there's two sides to it. You know, I'm not going to just say, oh, it's because of the COVID, all clubs are looking at loans because they're cost effective. They are. I mean, you know, there's been reports about Tammy Abraham at Chelsea, for instance, not being like he may leave, and then there's some big fees being touted around. But realistically, are they going to happen? You know, and the money isn't there in the same way to be spent. And so when you do bring in these loan players, it's a convenient method. If you're looking at, say, Fulham coming into the season with a tight turnaround at the start of the year, and you're thinking, okay, do the club then invest in the same way they did 2 years ago? And then does that therefore translate into a more guaranteed outcome of success? And, you know, the reality is the implications of 2 years ago are still being felt. You know, if we can see the financial fair play limits as Tony Khan has talked about, we'll get a clearer picture when we see the club's finances, just what sort of limits there are there. So it's hard to be certain on that, but when you do consider those factors and put them together, you make a case for loans. And, like, obviously, I mean, Ruben Loftus-Cheek hasn't worked out. I think we can all be pretty clear on that. It came in with the expectation that he was going to try and kick on like he did at Crystal Palace. Target was the Euros. From Chelsea perspective, it was to get one of a player that they value very, very highly to get him back up to speed. Fulham, it was the player that was going to provide that attacking impetus, you know, link up with Mitrovic, and that hasn't worked in all different ways. And there's no getting away from that. It hasn't worked in the way he wanted. I wouldn't say he's been terrible, but because of the expectations that have been on him, he hasn't lived up to them. And I think that's fair. I mean, we can get quite drastic about how players have done and how they haven't done in the context of what is a Fulham team that were battling the drop. But in terms of some of the other loans, I mean, they've all generally been a success. And I guess the main qualm is, you know, do you want to develop another team's players? And that's the thing you weigh up. Now, if Fulham stay up, a good deal of those loan players could become permanents. And then you're looking at a different sort of reality. Ola Aina's got an option. Mario Lemina's got an obligation. If Fulham stay up, Alphonse Areola's got an option as well. No guarantees, of course, if they join Fulham. But, you know, they're there. There's a pathway. And it's the ones like Ademola Lookman or Joachim Andersen, where there aren't those options there, that probably cause a bit more disappointment. But, you know, I there's always two sides to it. And I think there's always the sense that loans are bad, loans are good. You can't really operate like that. And especially at the moment, I don't think you can detach the fact that, you know, it's a difficult market. I mean, you look at the signings that were made permanently, they were brought in on very, very cheap money as well. So, I mean, there's definitely pros and cons. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, I would add to that. It's like one of those things where Loftus-Cheek has, you know, I've kind of come round to, I was with Peter in the up to the last couple of weeks. I thought that he was maybe getting slightly more stick than he deserved, but I think his performances of late have been incredibly insipid. And that has, I think, come to a boiling point where people are like, this is the point where we're supposed to be scrapping for our lives. And insipid performances at this point are just not what you need. And there is that element where he just seems to be half a yard short. And I think it's mental. You know, we said this at the start. It's like that worry about aggravating the injury. It's the worry at this point of the season, especially, I think, about aggravating the injury. There's one thing doing it in October, in November. But if you go a year out on loan, supposed to, you know, fix your fitness and get you minutes and whatever, and then you aggravate the injury again in May in a club that looks consigned to the drop, then maybe that's going to weigh heavy on him. And look, that's not me. That's not an excuse as far as I'm concerned. I think that should not be ever considered as, you know, anything worthwhile. And if that is how he feels about things, then don't play him. Because, you know, we need people in there fighting for every ball, scrapping for every ball. And it doesn't look like he is doing that at the moment. What I would say is that if Fulham had spent £30 million on Ruben Loftus-Cheek last summer, we would be looking at this in a far harsher light. No, we would be like on top brass wages, on, you know, probably the most, you know, expensive player at the club. Probably would have probably broken club records. We would have probably given him the top wage at the club. And if he had then turned in performances of this nature, we would be saying, what on earth was that? At least the loan system in this regard, I think, gives you the option to be like, no, that was bad. That was bad. I don't want anything to do with that. Like, and we should not exercise any options on trying to bring him in, or any funds or anything. And that is, I suppose, the beauty of the loan system in some ways. You get to look at people. You do get to try before you buy. And I would argue that maybe the bigger failures are not getting players like Joachim Andersen on options, on Ademola Lookman on options, because if there is, you know, Fulham do get relegated and you do have those options, there is at least then a pathway to say, look, believe in us, we believe in you, we think we can get straight back up next season if you give us that year. And I think not having those options is actually a bigger failure, because it means that we are set to lose the spine of this team. And that's not me defending the loan system. I think the loan system, as you say, Sammy, has potentially been stretched a little bit further than it needs to be. But actually the failure to secure options on players instead of just getting clean cut loans is arguably the bigger failure for me than the idea of a Loftus-Cheek coming in on loan, because at least at the end of a Loftus-Cheek loan, it's not been good. It's been bad. And it's not, you know, what we wanted it to be. But a lot of people were excited when he came in, you know, and a lot of fans were thinking, this is a player who I think can elevate us, can push us forward. He hasn't lived up to that. And now we send him back and be like, nope, thank you very much. That is, we are not going to be paying £30 million for that player because he is not worth it. And that's where we are.
Is there a connection? Andre Schürrle came from up the road. Ruben Loftus-Cheek came from up the road. Do we just shoot like...
Damien Duff came from up the road. Bjarne Golbeck came from up the road.
Maybe. I guess more recent history maybe hasn't fallen on them kindly. John Harley came from up the road?
Not directly, but yeah, I think so. Wayne Bridge came from up the road on loan. He was our best player that season.
He was a great player on loan that season. He really was. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And then afterwards, we've got lots to get into, including Tyrese Francois and Fulham's fatal final 15 minutes.
This is an advertisement for BetterHelp, a portal for finding online therapy. How's your social battery right now? If you feel a bit drained or lacking enthusiasm to meet all the social commitments in your life, then that can be a totally normal thing, especially with things picking up as we head out of winter. I know that pretty frequently a weekend just doing a few chores and watching the football was about the limit of my energy resources, but therapy can be a place to help you gain the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your batteries. Contrary to popular belief, therapy isn't just for those who have experienced major trauma. The overall goal is to empower you to be the best version of yourself. And if therapy is something you've considered, then why not give BetterHelp a try? BetterHelp is entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. They'll match you with a UK mental health professional with a wide variety of expertise. There's no referral needed, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge, giving you complete control over the whole experience. Fulhamish listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/fulhamish. That's betterhelp.com/fulhamish.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Part two of the Fulhamish podcast. Sammy James here, and I'm joined by Peter Rutzler.
Hello.
And Jack Collins.
Hello, listeners.
Peter, few pieces in The Athletic of note this week from a Fulham perspective that you've put out. And the first of those, which came out yesterday as we record, was a chat and a profile on Tyrese Francois. Now, not a player that obviously we'll be hugely familiar with unless we regularly see ourselves at under 23 games. And given the restrictions this year, that's not really possible for the majority of supporters. An Australian player who said to model himself on Andre Iniesta. Not a bad player to model yourself on, though, is it?
No. I mean, that's his sort of role model and his icon. And he had an interesting story, an interesting journey to Fulham. It's unusual to have an Aussie come through the ranks. But he moved to London when he was 14 with his family. It had a quirky link, actually, into how he joined Fulham. It was through his uncle, who owns a nightclub with Lee Chapman, the former Leeds striker, who knew someone at Fulham, and that's how the family came to Fulham's attention. So quite an unusual link that. But, he and his brother Marley Francois, both joined, were in Fulham's ranks. Marley left at 16. He's now at Bristol City, signed a pro contract last month. He's more of a tricky winger as opposed to Tyrese, who's quite a versatile midfielder. I spoke to him after the under-23s game on Monday. The 23s have had a difficult season, I think. They haven't played as well as I think they would have liked. They haven't picked up the points they would have liked. They played Leeds United, who are on course to win the Premier League 2, Division 2. That's the league they play in. Leeds have been using quite a few senior players. When Fulham went to Forbach in December, I think Helder Costa started, Tyler Roberts started, Ivan Pervaeda featured as well. But basically Marcelo Bielsa has just made sure that the reserves and the first team bubble are the same. So there's a lot more transition between them. Whereas at Fulham, there's two separate bubbles and also two separate bases, really. The under-23s and the under-18s, they have a whole new setup that has been built at LSE, as we've talked about before on the podcast. So it's been a little bit different. And for players like Tyrese, who was training with the first team at the start of the season, it's become that bit harder to get back into it. Tyrese injured his hamstring. He was out for 4 months. So he's had a bit of a setback. But he's made a couple of first-team appearances. He appeared against Sheffield Wednesday in the Carabao Cup. He was involved under Slavisa Jokanović during Fulham's previous Premier League stay. He went on a mid-season tour to Mercia with the first team squad, came off the bench again in the Carabao Cup. So, yeah, he's very well thought of. It was good to catch up with him and give a sort of a profile for a young player who, has shown a lot of potential, really. And at 20, still got a few years ahead of him. And, if we are looking at the Championship next season, then players like Francois and Fabio Carvalho will be wanting to really push on and see if they can get involved in pre-season and then potentially see if they can have some sort of squad role. But it's always a challenge jumping from the 23s, but it's been good to see him back playing, and he's now featured in 7 consecutive games since his injury. So he's doing well.
I think it's really interesting next season, Fulham, assuming we do go back to the Championship, and can we get these players into the first team? You remember that not so long ago, Steven Sessegnon, started a run of games for Fulham at the beginning of the Championship season. We all thought it was going to be his Ryan Sessegnon moment, but he made a couple of mistakes, particularly one against Nottingham Forest that meant Fulham conceded quite an important goal, and he never really got his place back in the team. But I'd like to hope with a full pre-season, as you mentioned, Peter, yes, we'll be chasing promotion. Yes, there'll be tense games where it's not sensible to throw in a youngster for his debut. But I think next season is maybe a bit of a watershed moment in, can we get some of these players minutes and hopefully the kind of amount of games in the Championship will allow Fulham to do that, because we will need to use more players.
I think it's interesting. I think we'll definitely delve into this in more detail as you know, relegation becomes more of a reality. I mean, as it looks like that's the direction of travel at the moment. But as you say, you know, it could well be a watershed moment because of the loans in the squad, because of those who will leave, because of those who will stay, how much of the old core that haven't really featured this year, how much are they going to be involved next year? Who are the club going to look to bring in? How are they going to do it? And which of these young players can stake a claim? So there's certainly an opening there. And of course, the balance is, if Fulham do want to make sure that they are absolutely cruising it next year and making their way straight back, which I think they should be doing and are in a position to do so, does that then again limit what these younger players can offer? And I think that's going to be quite an interesting sort of question. And I guess it also, you know, it looks at what Fulham also want to be. And I wonder how much of a sort of a reflective period it will become, where you say, well, what do Fulham want to put emphasis on? How important is it that Fulham get back into the Premier League and become a stable club again? Or is there going to be a more gradual approach? And maybe you could have said there was a look to do that in the Championship last season, to an extent, you know, with Scott Parker and building it. But, you know, it's an interesting inflection, I think, in Fulham's story. And four young players, that they'll all be looking and seeing what the sort of next step will be, what sort of opportunities they will have, because there are some talented young players in that team. And it's just about getting the balance right, because at the same time, you throw in a young player who's not ready for it into an environment where the team are expected to win every week, and suddenly that's really, really counterproductive. So it's a hard one to strike. But, you know, it will be a very interesting juncture.
Yeah, I'm interested in it because, you know, I think the case of Matt O'Riley is key here, right? And we spent so long talking about Matt O'Riley, and then he left the club and spent a little while without a club, and then went to MK Dons and started to, you know, put in some impressive performances in League One. Now he's been looked at by championship sides already for next season. And you're suddenly like, okay, maybe we did go too early and not give him a contract. But at the same time, the rumours around him were, oh, Dortmund are interested in him. And then, you know, to end up at MK Dons is a very different juncture in your career as to end up at Dortmund. So it's easy for us to overestimate players, I think, from the youth sides. And, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about Kieran Bowie and about Jay Stansfield, and about not throwing players in at the deep end before they're ready. Balance that with the fact that, you know, Tyrese Francois and Carvalho are incredibly talented footballers who are looked at as some people who have long-term futures with the club, Carvalho especially. And I do think it's about getting the minutes. Fulham have obviously given the least minutes to academy graduates of anyone this season in the Premier League. We haven't really seen anyone break through apart from Ryan Sessegnon in recent years, Emil Heinemann perhaps, and then that move to Bournemouth that didn't work out. He's over in MLS playing for Atlanta and doing fine, but, you know, that's a very different kettle of fish. And to see someone break through the academy, I think, and go on to make it would be a welcome boost for the academy, because, as you say, there is category, you know, one status. There is the fact that the Fulham Academy is regarded very highly, but also, you know, at some point, Fulham fans are going to want to see the rewards of that. If it is going to be something, you do want to see players coming through that pipeline and becoming part of the first team stature. And I think that's something that, if we can see next year, will be a massive morale boost to everyone involved.
I was going to say, I mean, morale boost is an interesting point, Jack, because there is, you see that with Arsenal a little bit, and it's interesting how sort of Mikel Arteta sort of been perceived. Now, obviously, there's some really talented young players they've got on their books there, but Emil Smith Rowe coming in, Bukayo Saka, Martinelli, I mean, he was brought in, he was signed in, but at the same time, when you do have that injection of youth into a team, it really does give the fans a lift. There's a little bit more investment in them. There's a bit more patience with them. But yeah, as we were saying before, there's a balance to strike. You know, if Fulham need to be winning games every week, can you be reliant on these players? Ideally, you'd want to be in positions in games where you are doing well enough to bring them on later and build up minutes that way, and then really assess them. But it doesn't always work out that way. And, you know, as Jack says, you know, it's one thing to score lots of goals at under 18 level and under 23 level. It's another thing entirely to do it, not just at Premier League or Championship level, but in the senior game as a whole.
Well, look at Troy Parrott, right? And Troy Parrott was seen at Spurs as the next great striker, you know, the next Harry Kane. That was how they were talking about him in youth level terms. And obviously, I have a vested interest in Troy Parrott being good. But like, it is one of those things where he went on loan to the Championship, struggled massively for 1 minute and two goals, has now gone to League One and is doing a little bit better, has leveled out a little bit. And look, he's still young. That's not me saying that he's not good enough. Harry Kane went on loan all over the place before he found his level. And I remember watching him at Leicester and being like, why are they bringing this clown on? But you know, it did take a while for him to find his feet. And I think maybe the same is true of Parrott. But it's also one of those things where you can't chuck these players in immediately and be like, of course they're going to score goals. Look how many he scored at youth level. It's easy to underestimate that jump I'm in.
Yeah, indeed. Well, another piece on The Athletic, Peter, is why Fulham's final 15 minutes of matches must make Fulham fans and Scott Parker nauseous. If ever there was a headline that reflected my feelings of ever watching a Fulham game, more accurately, I haven't seen one. Really interesting piece, Peter, and a lot of it reflecting on those kind of final crazy minutes at the Emirates Stadium, the 7 minutes added time, and just the catalogue of errors that led to the fatal outcome that probably is the game that has sealed Fulham's return to the Championship. Of course, we'll talk about in part three about maybe some attempts to try and rectify that damage. But a really interesting piece, not necessarily one that will shock us, but I guess some of the statistics were damning. Fulham having conceded 10 points after 75 minutes. In fact, that would be 12 points if you included the Sheffield United game where Fulham actually took the lead after the 75th minute. The statistics just in general really don't make pretty reading of how Fulham are performing in the final 15 minutes. And that is such a contrast to last season where we were so rock steady in the last 15 minutes of games. But I guess that was a league below.
Yeah, it's that level up. And you point to the headline. It's not exactly a headline that will get everyone very excited to read, I don't think. but yeah, I mean, it was interesting just to go back. And as you say, I think these are things that aren't necessarily surprising, but when you can just lay them out and actually see them, you think, okay, I can see what's sort of happening here. And the Arsenal game in particular was very interesting. Obviously, Fulham have had now three games consecutively where points have been dropped in the final 15 minutes, and all three games were different. I think we sort of discussed that before where, you know, the Arsenal game was very, very late. Wolves was sort of with Fulham pressing and pushing, trying to get the winner. It's a different sort of dynamic. And then Villa, of course, was a sort of a collapse. But the Arsenal one was interesting in that there are some common traits where things do go awry. And, you know, and they're not wholly unexpected, especially when you're in the position Fulham are in terms of pressure, in terms of needing to see games out, of actually being in that position, because most of Fulham's games are generally decided by single goal margins, if that. And that means that you are treading a fine line and small errors do count. But in particular on the Arsenal game, just watching through that period, because you get to 75 minutes and Fulham play very well in terms of retaining the ball, not taking too many risks and not doing things that put the team under excess pressure. And it's interesting how that can just go out the window. I mean, there were two sort of elements I picked up on really, which were communication and decision-making, which seemed very straightforward, but then you actually play them out. And I think the one example was Olerena just clearing the ball long, and which was absolutely fine. You know, Fulham had just come under a period of pressure. I think it was an Arsenal corner and Harrison Reed nicked it back. A couple of passes. He then sidesteps Danny Ceballos. And then you can hear on the audio, you can hear someone shouting, away, away, away. And you just wonder, I mean, why is that sense of panic, you know, that sort of change and suddenly goes long when there are actually three different options to retain possession and maybe Fulham can waste a few more seconds. I think there was another one where Anthony Robinson takes a throw in. Now, Robinson did brilliantly just before that, driving the ball up, lovely 1-2 with Loftus-Cheek. Gets a throw in the Arsenal half and then takes it, chucks it into the box to Loftus-Cheek, who has no one anywhere near him. He's surrounded by Arsenal players and it's just ceded possession. It's just those little tiny things just mean the pressure continues. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean the goal. I mean, the fact is Arsenal scored, you know, with essentially the final attack of the game, and it was 7 minutes of stoppage time and everything else. But these little things start to creep up in those moments. And it's actually trying to deal with those and actually trying to iron those creases out that can be the difference. And you know, when you're in the Premier League, those are the sort of fine margins between you know, staying in the division, picking up those points. I mean, 10 or 12 points difference for Fulham. I mean, it's crazy, really. And I think having watched the team all year, I think we all can recognise that there is enough ability to get those points. But whether they have, not just on a technical side, but on the experience side and the mental side, whether they're able to actually get those points over the line is perhaps a different thing.
I mean, Jack Scott has talked a lot since he came in about the importance of mental well-being in players. I mean, maybe not quite the right phrase there, but in terms of mindset, right? And how when he took over Fulham, they were a defeated club and he had to get in a psychologist to alter the mindset of the players. And actually this season, you look at those decisions late on that cost us against Arsenal. That's not tactics. That's not the shape of the team. That's not really his substitutions. That's the players not being prepared enough or experienced enough to deal with the extreme pressure that came in those final 7 minutes against a big side and getting a big scalp away from home.
Yeah, look, I agree with you to a point. I do think that when you put seven defenders on, you're setting them up to be like, you're going into siege mode. You know, like there's something in that. And it's easy to be like, oh, it's not the tactics. But when you put that amount of defenders on the pitch, you're hardly saying, oh, we're going to go and get another one, are you? You know, you're trying to bolt the lock. And I do think that there's something in that, you know, with Fulham so under the cosh, just piling defender after defender after defender onto the pitch, show it is a kind of mindset thing from the coach as well as the players. It's going, you know, we're not getting out of this. This is backs to the wall and there's 10 minutes left. And, you know, Fulham are lining up on the edge of their own box being like, right, they do not come past this wall. And that's an incredibly difficult thing to see out for that amount of time against a team as talented as Arsenal, against any team in the Premier League, frankly, but again, especially against a team with as much talent in the ranks as Arsenal. So, yes, I think it's mental. And yes, I do think it's psychological. But I don't think that is helping. I don't think throwing seven defenders onto the pitch is exactly what Fulham are after, because it's a strange. And look, we talked about this at the Villa game, right? That Scott didn't make any substitutions. I'm not suggesting here that him making subs in the first place is a bad thing. I think freshening up at that point and changing things around is important for Fulham to try and look at it and think, okay, how do you do this? But I do think that when you hit seven defenders onto the pitch with 10 minutes to go, you are saying to the players, right, there's no way we're getting any more. Defend for your lives. And that's basically what they then went and tried to do. And it does lead to panicked moments. It does lead to people not retaining possession. It does lead to the fact that Fulham were basically unable to hold onto the ball for those last 7 minutes.
Yeah, indeed.
I think Jack's absolutely right. I think that's the other side to it. There's definitely two parts. There's absolutely that tactical element to it, where in all three of those games, you've seen Fulham drop deeper. You've seen Fulham shut up shop. You've seen the changes, or against Villa, the changes not as proactive as Villa was to deal with them. Or then you see that the Arsenal game where Joe Bryan comes on and you are forming essentially a back seven. And it does that. That's the message, isn't it? It's two ways. It's to say, look, we are going to shut up shop. We are going to be defensive because this is what's going to happen. Now, there's two ways of looking at it. Is that a case of saying, I know this is going to happen because I think the players are naturally going to end up in this position and I'd rather be better equipped? Or is it the other way? And as Jack says, it just reinforces the mindset that actually, do you know what, we're going to come under pressure. But it's both of those factors together. And that's why you do end up losing these points, really. And there's not necessarily an easy solution, because the flip side is, well, okay, you keep chasing for that second goal, but then you leave yourself open against what is quite a good team. So finding that right balance is what Fulham haven't been able to do.
Yeah, indeed. And one final kind of bit of Fulham news from this week before we do preview the derby. Fulham and I think pretty much all clubs in the Premier League and Football League are going to join in a social media boycott this weekend. I believe that there are other publications. Fulhamish is going to be joining in it. I think most of Fulham fan media is going to be joining in it as well. I've had a couple of conversations with the likes of Fulham Focus, Cottage Talk, Camien, Friends of Fulham, Jack and Loz, who are all going to take part, and there's others as well. I'd just be interested to know your thoughts on the social media boycott and whether you think it will change anything. I know I've got my views on it, but I don't think that, by the way, that if you disagree with it, then anyone's necessarily going to think bad of you. I think it's got its pros and cons, this kind of token gesture that is being put forward. Do you think it's got the ability to make real change? Jack, I'll start with you if you want.
I think it's a little bit insipid in some ways. I'm glad that there is things being done. So like, I think there is a level that some action is always better than no action. In these regards, but I do think that there is a point to be made that if we could, you know, last week we saw UEFA and clubs threatening to boycott leagues, threatening to, you know, discuss, you know, throwing clubs out of tournaments when they threaten to break away into their own. But when, you know, a Slavia Prague player racially abuses a Rangers player in the UEFA, in the Europa League, which is a competition that I hold incredibly dearly to my heart, you know, there's no talk of boycotts. There's no talk of sanctions. There's no talk of throwing people out of the competition. And there was nothing from the clubs in question who were going through. You know, it wasn't Arsenal and Man United and Roma and Villarreal saying, we're not playing in this tournament unless you throw them out, because people are, you know, they're wary of doing things like that. So I do think that there is a level of this that you have to kind of hope that people are going to stand up harder. But on the whole, you know, social media platforms are somewhere that hatred is spread. And if this is the nudge that Twitter and Facebook and Instagram need in order that they think that something can be done to change the methods of reporting racism, of getting accounts banned for racial abuse, then it's good. It's a good thing. If it gets, you know, 10 more of those accounts banned than would have been otherwise, and Facebook and Instagram and Twitter wake up even the slightest bit to the abuse that's being handed out on their platforms day by day, then it's a good thing. So yes, I want clubs to do more than this. I don't think, like you say, it's a token gesture. If it has real effect on social media platforms, fantastic. And then let's see more steps. It can't be this is our gesture and that's our gesture for the year.
I think it is important, purely from an awareness perspective as much as anything. And this does make a stronger impact than just the constant pointing out. I mean, it's just been relentless. Player after player coming out, showing the types of abuse they're receiving. And that doesn't seem to have any impact on social media companies. It doesn't seem to have enforced any sort of change or action to change. And if it means taking yourself off the platform, you know, these are people with immense numbers of followers. You know, these are people that bring people to the platform itself. You know, if it means taking them off for a few days to raise the point, and that will reach a lot of people, then that for me is a good thing. But it can't be the only thing. It has to be met with some kind of change, and it needs some kind of further enforcement. Now, how you do that is complicated. You know, there's one of the common sort of debates concerning social media is concerns. Proving your identity to open an account, whereas at times there are people who have anonymous accounts because by not having an anonymous account and being able to say what they're able to say, whether that be political or human rights or any other reason, having that element to their account would be limiting, and suddenly you're affecting it in that way. So I don't think there are easy solutions, particularly to the issue of social media abuse. But, you know, I mean, what fundamentally is happening is that not enough is being done to stop it. Not enough is being done to intervene and to prevent these sort of messages impacting players and everyone else. It's not just that, you know, from media to everyday people. It's you often see it that copyright breaches will get taken down a lot quicker than some forms of abuse. And when you do see those sort of elements, you do question it. And That's what these things are about. They're about trying to force these companies to act. You know, why should someone go on their platform to experience and to enjoy it in whatever way they want, and yet their price for it is to take abuse? Now, you can easily just say, don't use it. But why should they be hounded out? Why should they be deprived of the right to use it for, you know, their social reasons, for their friends, for everything else? So it's a difficult topic, but, you know, action needs to be done, and, you know, the boycott is a good step forward.
At first, when I saw it, and I saw the clubs, a few clubs coming out of it, I think Swansea were one of the first clubs to do it for a weekend. I remember thinking it's a drop in the giant ocean that is social media. I do think this collective action is impressive. I didn't think I'd see the day where all clubs on a certain weekend, an important weekend in the season, you know, where titles and promotions and relegations are starting to be decided, where they've actually gone, no, you know what, we're not going to post. If you want to follow the game, you can watch it or go on the website. I think is really, really impressive. And I still don't believe social media companies do anything about racism, because at the end of the day, it doesn't cost anyone money. Really. It doesn't cost anyone a dollar. And I don't honestly think, right, I'm not some giant tech expert that would understand the exact specifics of doing it. But if the technology is in place that you can spot a random Twitter account posting a video of a goal through their phone, and you've got the automatic technology to be able to recognize that someone's done that and shut it down within hours, then how can you not have the technology to spot that a new anonymous account with zero followers and following two people is saying the N-word or is sharing obscene messages to anyone? Like, how can that not raise a flag at someone at Twitter HQ for them to go, hang on, we got a bad egg here, and just shut it down? No one should be using any of those words. And yes, I know that there might be ways of getting around those bots and stuff, and you're going to have to be constantly adapting your technology. But we live in a world where users are expected to report the crimes themselves. And then half the time, Twitter go, yeah, that doesn't break our regulations. And you're like, sorry, the person just wished my family would be burnt in a house fire. How can that not be breaking you any of your regulations? And that's what I hope that this weekend does. You can call it tokenistic, you can call it pointless, but football is a big driver of traffic, particularly to Twitter. I don't know if Instagram and Facebook will notice, but particularly to Twitter, I think it is a massive driver of traffic, and it's not just blowing football's self-importance. I think, honestly, sports is a huge, huge market for Twitter. And I think, hopefully, even if it's only in the UK, Twitter will notice. And if it even just means that one more meeting is had at Twitter HQ of how to combat this, then I think it's a worthwhile gesture. And I'm really glad to see that also the rest of the Fulham community has come together to support the club in it this weekend. And it'll be a bit weird if Fulham do get a result this weekend against that lot up the road, that none of us can celebrate or put some flame emojis when Mitrovic inevitably gets an 89th minute winner at the shed end. But that's how it has to be this weekend, and we'll just have to enjoy it in other ways, like with our friends and with our family. God forbid we can't tweet when Fulham win this weekend. So yeah, that's my two pence on the matter. We'll take a quick break and then we'll look ahead to this weekend's game.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Part three of the Fulhamish podcast. It's Sammy here with Jack and Peter. Let's look ahead then to Saturday's game against Chelsea at the Bridge, 5:30 on Saturday. It's live on Sky in the UK. And Jack, an interesting time for Chelsea. They are chasing the top four. This is an important game for them, but they are also sandwiched in between two much, much more important games, which of course is Madrid in the semi-finals of the Champions League. They had a good result on Tuesday, 1-1 away, not at the Bernabeu. Whatever the training ground's called.
Oh, the Bebas.
Oh, very, very nice. And they might rest some players, but I don't think they'll go for a full squad change, will they?
Yeah, I think they're going to have to rotate. I was watching the monsoon come down at the Di Stefano and thinking maybe they'll get colds. But I do think that's potentially a little bit optimistic in my thought process. Look, it was a tough game, and actually 1-1 is potentially quite a good result for us, because yes, they're in a good position and they'll feel that they can progress. But also there's still a lot of work to be done. So they will have to rotate this weekend. The problem with that is that Chelsea's squad is incredibly deep, and they have the pieces to rotate with if they need them. And then when you look at that and you think, okay, they will be able to do this, and you look at how Tuchel has worked his squad this year, and look at how he rotated even for like the City game in the semi-final of the FA Cup, he's basically got most things right. You know, the West Brom game aside, there's not many blots on Thomas Tuchel's copy book since he went in at Walham Green. So, you know, you look at the whole thing of what he's done and how good, sadly, they have been over the last couple of weeks. And I do think he'll ring the changes, but I am sadly not completely convinced that that's going to be enough. You know, the changes will know exactly where they are. We're going to look at, bear in mind, we're going to be looking at players who are not only playing for that, you know, domestic security of getting fourth place and trying to prove that, but also trying to play their way into a potential Champions League final 11. You know, they're, these are players who will be looking to make their mark and be like, why am I being overlooked? I shouldn't be, because if you'd played me, this is what I can do. And I worry that that rotation might hurt us as much as help us in some ways.
I mean, Peter, do you think it's a good or a bad time to face Chelsea? Part of me thinks now as well that if Fulham are staying up this season, if we are to do it, and I think it's really, really unlikely, I think we have to win 4 out of 5, which means we either have to win at Chelsea or we have to win at United plus win the 3 winnable games. It's all very, very difficult. It sounds mad to say that we have to get a result at Stamford Bridge, doesn't it? It sounds absolutely bonkers to say that it's a must-win game to go to Stamford Bridge and win, but it is. It is, sadly.
You just talked yourself into resignation there. You listed that and then there was a very audible sigh. So, yeah, I think that sort of sums up how much of a challenge this weekend is going to be. I do agree. You're looking at 4 wins, maybe 3 if things elsewhere, someone bombs entirely, but it's a really, really tough ask at this point. And we are in extraordinary escape territory, really. And I would have to start on Saturday, but is it a good time to face Chelsea? I just don't know if there is a good time to face Chelsea. I think Jack made the point very, very, very well about how the players will be wanting to play into that Champions League team, as well as fighting for the top 4. Thomas Tuchel has got them extremely well organised. You know, they don't give goals away at all, apart from against West Brom, which is unusual, and will be intriguing to see how that sort of reflects this weekend. But, you know, in terms of the way they set up defensively, the options they've got going forward, even the rotation, you know, you're looking at maybe a start for Havertz and Ziyech and Reece James, who all came off the bench in Spain. So it's going to be a difficult task. The only hope is that the eye is off the ball. And, you know, there is fortune in that this game has landed between the 2 Real Madrid games, because that's the big focus. That's what they'll be wanting to focus on entirely, really. And yes, the top 4 is big, but those are the such important games for an individual, for a player to want to be involved in. And, you know, the flip side of that is you don't want to get yourself injured for those games. And that also plays on players' minds too. But the thing for Fulham is, you know, Fulham have been competitive most of the season. They tend to have tight, we've talked about it earlier, single goal margins in matches. Chelsea have been very similar in that sort of respect. They don't give goals away. They keep things very tight. But they hold really good control over matches. And how Fulham force their way into that, take the chances when they come, you know, that's the difference. It's been the difference all season, really. And it matters more in these games. And I think when you're looking at Chelsea and United away, I don't know, United can have the potential to blow hot and cold. So I've looked at the Chelsea game as being the tougher one, just because of how well Tuchel has been playing. But if you win at Stamford Bridge, that's a huge, huge boost for the team. And, you know, and then it makes survival a possibility again, because at the moment, as your sigh showed, Sammy, it doesn't feel like that at the moment.
No, I mean, it would send a shockwave, Jack, to the rest of the relegation rivals. I mean, how do you think Scott needs to play it this weekend? What kind of changes would you make, if any, from that Arsenal game?
Try and swamp that midfield. I think that they might give N'Golo Kante a rest, given how good he was on Tuesday night and how important he is to this side. So I would maybe try and swamp that midfield. I would maybe try and go with the 3-man midfield of Anguissa, Lamina and Harrison Reed all together, especially given that the Ruben Loftus-Cheek can't play. Not that I would have probably started him either way, but that's not the point. I'd go back to a back 4. I know they're going to play with a 5. But I think you've got to try and push on that and got to try and dominate the middle a little bit more here and try and make sure that the spaces aren't there for them to be picking passes through the middle. So I would go Areola, Aina, Tete, Anderson, Adebayo, Anguissa, Lamina, Reed, Lookman, Mitrovic, Bobby Reed.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think I can't see Mitrovic necessarily playing in this game. I think Parker will probably, based on form, and you look at how Fulham have set up in those typical away games, they try to be more fluid in attack. And I think, you know, you bring in Cavallero because of his ability to retain the ball. I think he's done that very well, and he's one of Fulham's best when it comes to that element of his game. Maybe a free of Lookman, Cavallero and Bobby Decadova-Reed. Decadova-Reed on the right, giving that flexibility for a five, which may be needed if Chelsea pin Fulham back with the way they set up with a three and the wing-backs. On that right-hand side, of course, it could be Marcus Alonso after Chilwell played, and Alonso does like to get forward. So trying to negate that threat, have that sort of dynamism, and maybe play Lookman through the middle like Fulham did against Manchester United at home. Lookman showed he can finish. Maybe you say Madjer, but I don't think Madjer is as dynamic, I think, as Fulham may need when they don't have the ball. And just being able to flood that midfield, as Jack says, will be really, really important, and complementing that midfield. I do think it's a big game for someone like Anguissa. We gave him a lot of praise at the start of the season because of his performances. He's been in and out of the team since then, and he hasn't really had the impact that we all know that he can have. It's in these games, these big games. You know, he did well against Manchester City, I remember, and we haven't really seen that so much. Did well against Leicester. You need him to stand up here. You need him to take the ball and to drive with it and to bring Fulham up the field, because without Loftus-Cheek, as much as he's been given a lot of criticism, the attacking impetus will fall on one of the three in midfield if Fulham go with a three. So, especially when he looks tired to the summer. You know, if Fulham are going down, I don't think he'll see himself in the Championship.
Yeah.
He's lost a little bit of that early momentum, I would say, from this campaign, and trying to rebuild that. You know, that goes for a lot of players in this Fulham team. You know, there's always the full process that the lone players are thinking about themselves coming into the summer, and sure, I'm sure they will be. That will be at the back of their minds, because you know they've got their careers to focus on. But you know, a lot of them have got points to prove still. You know, this is a squad full of players who haven't played in the Premier League properly, and none of them will want a relegation on their CV. And if you want to really make a mark, it's in these games, these big games. So, and Fulham need them to stand up, especially with time running out.
Yeah, I actually would be tempted to stick with a similar lineup to what played against Arsenal. I know you say Madge is not that mobile, but I do just rate his ability to sometimes find a goal out of nothing. We haven't really seen it of late, but we obviously saw it in those two goals against Everton. We did see it against Spurs. Like, everyone forgets, everyone thinks he only scored two goals. He scored against Spurs for the sake of a stupid VAR handball that was never a handball against Mario Lemina. Madja had a swivel and a finish and a great goal against Tottenham. And also, I was really impressed with how he stuck away that penalty against Arsenal. Yeah. I know it's a penalty, but given how we struggled, it was nice to see. So I'd be tempted. The only thing that I don't like about the lineup that we had against Arsenal is I do just think Harrison Reed, for me, deserves the start. And I don't like seeing him come off the bench, although he was very effective off the bench in that game. Especially, I thought he was the only person that looked like keeping us in that game. His kind of tireless running gives, when he comes off the bench, gives him even more kind of motivation to run like a madman and put out fires all over the pitch for Fulham.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there, Sammy. I think Reed. I wonder if the Reed selection was just a case of, you know, Lamina scored goals, scored a goal. Reed hasn't necessarily. I mean, his impact, I think, was it West Brom where he came off and delivered that fantastic cross for Cavallero, shows that he can influence things in the final third. So I think having him back in the team is important, especially against this Chelsea team who are going to make Fulham work very, very hard.
Yeah, indeed. All right, well, we'll see what happens this weekend at the Bridge. I don't think we can say we're expecting, but always believing. You never know. Could this be the start of a great escape? It seems extraordinarily unlikely, but I'm sure we'll be watching with bated breath and a little bit of hope inside us. I know that much of the hope has gone for many of you, but I still hold a very, very small amount. Okay, that will do for today. We'll be back on Sunday. We're still going to be doing a podcast this weekend, despite the social media blackout. It's very much a social media blackout, not a content blackout. So Fulhamish will still be doing the podcast on Sunday, looking back at that game at the Bridge. All that remains to be said is thank you, Peter.
No, thank you, Sammy. It's been a pleasure as always.
Great. And thank you very much, Jack Collins.
Thank you so much for having me as ever, Sammy. Thank you, Peter, for all your insight. It's been fun. I love Thursday Club. And I'll see you all soon.
Oh, very good. Okay, right. We'll be back on Sunday. Have a good bank holiday weekend here in the UK. Come on, you Whites.